Hello, everybody, and welcome to the extended free preview of our What a Cartoon Movie episode of Cool World. I'm one of your hosts, Bob Mackie, and I'll tell you what, Mackie would if he could, but instead, he had to watch Cool World, and who is here with me today, as always.
Why, it's Henry Gilbert, and I promise on this podcast I will make sure no cartoon characters run through the center of it.
Thank God, that's very distracting. And yes, this is our monthly What a Cartoon Movie podcast, so welcome, of course.
Welcome.
And this month, in the month of May of 2021, we are talking about the Ralph Bakshi classic, in quotes, Cool World, his last feature film in a gigantic disaster that nobody likes and no one wants to remember except for us because our patrons voted for it. And we have one of the most in-depth histories of Cool World on the internet, I dare say.
Oh, yes. Yeah. We're joined by Thad Komorowski, who, as part of his larger work in animation history, knows a ton about Ralph Bakshi, especially in the early 90s when many Bakshi acolytes were running the world of cartoons meanwhile Cool World was happening and ending his career.
And because our buddy Thad is on it, this is a super-sized history segment. You'll hear a small portion of that, but if you want to hear the whole thing, as well as our entire three-hour movie discussion, if you want to hear that and the entire history, head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Sign up at the $10 level. You can hear all of this podcast, plus the past how many months of this have we done? We're in 2.5 years, I think, of What a Cartoon Movie so far.
Yeah, November it'll be 3 years, so we're getting really close to the third anniversary. I would say there are over 130 hours, maybe even 140 hours now at the $10 level, and that you get to hear the entire giant back catalog, so many cartoons that we cover as extensively as Beavis and Butthead to Akira and tons in between, and we work hard on these goddamn histories. We really do. And I think you guys will really appreciate them. Our Shrek one last month also, boy, everybody loved that one. If you want to hear about Cool World, Shrek right after, it is a fun combo of movies to hear talked about.
That's right. So if you sign up for $10 a month, you get the $5 level stuff as well. That includes all of our limited miniseries we've done since the beginning of this Patreon nearly 4 years ago. So that's over 100 bonus podcasts, miniseries like Talking of the Hill, Talking Futurama, Talking Mission Hill, Talking Critic, and so many more things are waiting for you if you sign up at the $10 level. Of course, all of the $5 level things are yours as well. And the $10 stuff also includes all of the video things that we did on the Patreon as well, like looking at all the Simpsons shorts on the Tracy Ullman show and things like that. So yes, it's all happening behind the paywall at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
And also, you know, he doesn't get to plug it in the clip here, but Thad Komorowski, he and Bob Jakes, animation experts, they both do a great podcast as well you should check out called Cartoon Logic, where they delve into many classic cartoons that we often don't cover on What a Cartoon. So check out Cartoon Logic if you enjoy hearing all this from Thad.
So that is it for this little introduction. So please enjoy our free extended preview of this month's What a Cartoon Movie episode all about Cool World. And for this history of Ralph Bakshi, I'm going to go from his birth to Fritz the Cat and then skip ahead in time about 20 years to Cool World, because there's simply too much to cover. A Ralph Bakshi podcast would be a series. We can't possibly cover this his entire life in one podcast, because he started animating at like 18. He was in the animation industry at 18, very early in his life.
Yeah, that's sort of he's sort of the last gasp. Well, he's not really the last gasp with that model, but there's that apprenticeship model doesn't happen anymore. Mm-hmm. So, he grew up. He was in New York. He immigrated. Yeah, right. That's right. He wasn't. He's not a U.S. citizen, really. I don't know. Actually, he might be. I don't know. But yeah, he grew up in New York, and he started at Terrytoons just as Paul Terry had sold the studio to CBS and left all of his cohorts hanging. Ralph's an interesting dude. He's kind of a pretty shitty filmmaker. I think that's very fair.
Before we get too deep into the Ralph Bakshi discussion, Thad, I do want to ask everybody here, what is our experience with Cool World? I neglected that.
Oh, yes.
And as for me, this was heavily marketed to me, a 10-year-old boy, for reasons that will become more apparent as we talk about the history of the movie, because it was going to be a much darker R-rated movie, but then there was a 180-degree turn, and they wanted to market it to kids as well. And yes, as for me, It seemed appealing. It didn't have the immediate Roger Rabbit appeal that I wanted out of the movie, so I didn't see it in theaters. I saw Roger Rabbit in theaters when I was six, and I loved it. And then I eventually saw this on VHS, whenever it came out on VHS. And I remember not enjoying it. And upon watching it again nearly 30 years later, I don't enjoy it for the same reasons. And I do remember I was only 10, so maybe I was 11 when it came out on video. But the hormones had not really started working yet, but I was like interested in, ooh, naked ladies. Where can I see those? And I knew how movie ratings worked, and I knew that Hollywood would not get naked in this movie, but I was still disappointed that she didn't when I was 11. And that was really what I walked away with Cool World thinking. Like, oh, I thought she was going to be naked.
Hollywood not be naked.
Exactly. Not in the PG-13 version.
Same age as you, Bob. I loved Roger Rabbit, and I think definitely the ads for this were hitting me right when I was reading comic books, and there were ads all over the place in them. Like I became a hardcore comic book reader, specifically superhero comics, in 1992, and I probably would have been very bored by this, but also it seemed like a movie that I would have been embarrassed to ask my mom to take me to. So I couldn't even think to go like, Mom, let's go to Cool World like that. It would be embarrassing. But
I think the same thing happened with me, where I felt like some shame in asking to go see it, but there was no shame in taking the video off the shelf and handing it to my stepdad to rent for me.
Oh, sure.
Oh, Cool World,
That's probably what led to its failure at the box office. I'm embarrassed to go ask to go see this.
Yeah, same with like Showgirls. Like people, like there were these dirty movies that people, by the 90s, everyone's like, I'm going to watch this at home alone in my shame. I don't want people to know I'm watching this.
Draw the blinds.
Showgirls at least had real nudity in it.
That's true.
This didn't even have that.
I didn't watch Cool World until about a decade ago.
Oh, really?
When I'd seen snippets of it and thought, oh, there's some good animation in here. Like I saw those tiny snippets, and I also thought it was a film that starred Brad Pitt. So then once I finally watched it, like a decade ago for the first time, that's when I finally went like, boy, I'm glad I didn't see this when I was like 13 or 14, because I would have just been bored out of my mind by this thing. And I now know a little more of animation history, so at least there's some bits I'm like, oh, that's interesting from that angle, I suppose. I can talk myself into being interested at times, but as a film that tells a story, it really doesn't work at all. Yes.
And Thad, you're a bit younger than us, so obviously way too young to see this when it came out in theaters and on VHS, but what is your experience with this movie?
Traumatic, but let's see. It showed up randomly on one of the HBO channels, and I saw that it was on. It was about 20 minutes into it. It was the part with the rabbit or whatever. And as you know, missing 20 minutes of a Ralph Bakshi movie, you're not really, you know, you can still follow as much as you can of it. You know, it doesn't matter what point you tune into it.
Yeah.
I mean, I just saw it and it's like, all right, well, okay, they replaced the word tune with doodle. Okay. you know, it's just, for one, people probably know I'm not really a fan of Roger Rabbit either, but I mean, this is Citizen King compared to this. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I know, Thad, you're not a fan of Roger Rabbit, but we're going to be making a lot of Roger Rabbit comparisons throughout this podcast, and that's going to be unavoidable because that is what it's selling itself as.
Oh, comparisons are Roger Rabbit ripoff.
Exactly.
Of course you gotta.
But even if you don't like Roger Rabbit, that succeeds on a technical level that this utterly fails at. Just thinking about all the things they do in that movie that this movie barely does, and rewatching it, I was just noticing like, everything is just like a painted prop up cardboard set because they don't want these cartoons to actually interact with the world. If you think of Roger Rabbit, there's like floating live action guns in the air.
Yeah.
Cartoons are touching human beings. They're ruffling their clothes and their hair. There's like one moment I can think of in this movie where like a cartoon is affecting the like body and clothing of another character. And it basically feels just like a rotoscoped hand going up Gabriel Byrne. And there's like a really embarrassing scene where Brad Pitt has his arm around his girlfriend and it just looks like his arm is hanging in the air. There's no sense of reality or weight. Zemeckis would have made him put his arm around something physical would have drawn over that.
Well, even the sex scene is so artificial too. It's like the guy isn't even reacting.
Yeah.
Like he's embarrassed. He's petrified of what am I doing with my life right now?
It's true. Everyone looks embarrassed to be in this movie, yeah. except maybe for Kim Basinger. And Brad Pitt, I think, is too young to know what he's like in for this movie. But yeah, and we'll talk about it later, but it just fails technically on so many levels. And that sex scene, like, even now I'm thinking, did they have sex? It's very strange.
You don't know what the story is. I mean, you know, did he come in her and that's why she became Kim Basinger? I don't know.
That was my assumption.
If anything, this movie needs rules.
Yeah.
Rules for its world. It's cool world, if you will.
Well, yeah.
It's Ralph's world. We just live in it.
Yeah.
So that's...
I guess with Bakshi as well, he is more the type of guy just like, well, it's just a thing. It just is. Like, who cares? Like, next scene. Rewatching it too gave me more appreciation for the technical ability on display in Roger Rabbit, because of, like, early on, Brad Pitt is talking to Hollywood for the first time, and they're sort of, he's like, he shoves her a couple times, and then the camera pulls back as she's giving a big speech, but her scale doesn't change with the movement. I was like, oh, I guess that's the imperceptible things that if they do it correctly, you don't notice that, like, oh, Roger Rabbit is changing in scale because a camera movement is happening. In this one, the character isn't changing in size because that's a lot harder to do.
It just feels like things are often floating on top of this live action footage
with
no sense of weight.
And as a New Yorker, he should be really embarrassed about this, because New York started the whole live action animation thing with Max Fleischer and Coco the Clown. So he should be double ashamed that he couldn't pull it off any better than Max could.
Well, let's talk a bit about Ralph Bakshi, where he came from. Again, very long history. He's still alive as of this recording. And let's talk about, he was born in Mandatory Palestine in 1938, because the history of that region is very complicated, and I won't go into it in one podcast. But if you're born
starting in a bad, weird place.
If you're born in something called Mandatory Palestine, it seems like political situation's a bit iffy. I'm making the hand motion there.
Yeah.
So that could be why this Jewish family emigrated to the United States just a year later. And Bakshi grew up relatively poor in Brooklyn, obsessed with comic books. And what would later inform his life and his later movies is that his father moved his family temporarily to the Washington, D.C. Foggy Bottom neighborhood that was a segregated black neighborhood. He was already being othered by being a Jewish boy, but he was with these people that were even more othered. And if you look at the subject matter of his future movies, you could see he was speaking from a place of experience, living amongst these different cultures who were othered in a different way than he was. So after that brief stay in Foggy Bottom, Bakshi's family moved back to Brooklyn. Bakshi was a poor student and was seemingly a rowdy character we know him as today. So his principal transferred him to the Manhattan School of Industrial Art, and he graduated from there in 1956. And after that, right after graduating, he got a job at Terry Toons as a cell polisher, which means you clean the dirt and grime off of cells.
Man, jeez.
Well, he worked up at Terry Toons, they would work you up the ranks pretty fast. So I forget when he became an assistant, but by 59, he was getting screen credits as an animator. So yeah, that's why they actually on the Mighty Mouse box set of the TV show, they had a couple of the theatrical shorts as bonuses, and they specifically picked one because it had Ralph Bakshi in the screen credits. So
yeah, looking into this Terry Toons stuff, that history is written by the winners. And when I was growing up, the old cartoons, in quotes, were either Warner Brothers cartoons or Hanna-Barbera. There was no Terry Toons available to me. They are not being shown to me. So going back into all of these cartoons, looking at the titles of them, they all feel like Itchy and Scratchy and Friends ripoffs, like Deputy Dog and Sad Cats. All of these things I've never heard of. They look at times worse than Hanna-Barbera, but it's the same kind of limited animation that Hanna-Barbera was known for. But Again, these things were not shown. I mean, maybe Henry has seen them and I haven't, but these were not as available. These were out of circulation when I was growing up in the 80s, before cartoons got really good.
I barely remember seeing any Terry Toons as a kid. I think this is skipping ahead, but the late 80s, Mighty Mouse was how I was introduced to the character, and I thought he was really cool. And occasionally after that, I think I would happen upon old Mighty Mouse, or I would see the Andy Kaufman famous moment from SNL. I was like, oh, Mighty Mouse was an older thing. Huh? Like I didn't. I guess occasionally you'd see like a Heckle and Jekyll on TV, but if I even saw that, I would say like, is Muppet Babies on? Like I want to see something. I know, but that was colorful and fun and had clips from Star Wars in it.
I just know that Heckle and Jekyll were at Homer's funeral.
Yes,
there goes a real sack of crap.
Oh, best joke. Yeah, they were last seen on the USA Network. They ran them up until maybe 93 or 94.
Wow, okay.
If you find a Terry Toon online, sometimes a lot of the times they'll have the USA bug on the corner. So it's like, I don't know when they'd show them. They probably showed them like after what was that thing Gilbert Gottfried hosted at 1 in the morning, and then they'd show a Heckle and Jekyll between them or something.
Up all night?
So, yes.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe something like that. That's where they'd show them. I can firmly say that I never saw a Terry Toon on television. So, yeah, and I think I saw every other of the old studios in some form on TV, but never a Terry Toon. I think the only person who was ever interested in marketing those things was Paul Terry himself, and once he died, the whole Terry Toon organization folded. So, he died in 71 and it was gone in 72. No one cared. So
I think of Terry Toon characters being on the like $5 VHS tape of like an hour of cartoons, and it's like they're colored wrong, and then they're standing next to like a World War II Daffy Duck cartoon that they don't show on TV anymore.
It's real weekend dad entertainment.
Yes.
That's what I think of it as. Yeah. But so at Terry Toon's back, she was bristling against the factory-like nature of this animation production. And by the mid-60s, CBS, who owned Terry Toon's, shrugged at most of their pitches because Hanna-Barbera was just kicking their ass left and right. Mm. And in desperation, Bakshi pitched this superhero parody called The Mighty Heroes, and he was the creative director of that 20-episode series. So that was the first time I think he was the creator of a series or had a major creative role. No one out there cares, but he also might have co-created Sad Cat. So
pretty sure he did, yeah. Well, he designed the character, I know, so that's of his design. He was starting to do more and more stuff at Terry Toons. You know, he's sort of like the, he's the loudest one in the room, maybe not necessarily the most talented. So he would get the job and he would get the promotions, and then he would shit the bed and then go on to another thing.
And failing upwards, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And he basically was at Terry Toons for, I think, a little over a decade. And after that, he was looking for new opportunities, and Paramount Studios just fired the former head of their animation department. So Bakshi assembles a team and takes over that department. That team finishes that former head's unfinished films, and then they make four of their own, and I think most of them are online. But after Bakshi does his own films, Paramount closes their animation department entirely, and apparently they always planned on doing that.
That was a weird situation at Paramount in the 60s. Like, they would hire and fire someone every other season. First it was Howie Post, the Harvey cartoonist, was running things for a year and a half or so. Then it was Seamus Culhane, and then when Seamus was fired, as far as I know, Ralph didn't try to get Seamus fired, but who knows. But and then Ralph was in, and Howard Beckerman, who's still alive, he's an old New York cartoonist and animator who's been a mainstay at SVA for a million years. He told me he went back the day Howard had been working at Paramount, and he didn't work with Bakshi there, but he had left something of his at the office. And when he heard, he's like, well, I'll go get it another day. And he kept putting it off. And then he knows, they're closing the place down. And he goes over there, and basically Bakshi had destroyed his whole office, like in a rage.
Oh,
and, well, someone commented, well, that could have been just any day with Ralph. But it was really sad, because don't forget, you know, it was still the same studio that did Betty Boop and Popeye. So no matter how many years and incarnations had passed, you know, that was truly the end of an era.
Yeah,
seeing
what,
that closed down on such a whimper.
What was Paramount even doing in the late 60s? I looked at some of these Bakshi shorts. I had never seen them. I don't know what movies they were attached to, but they were just completely foreign to me, these ones he worked on.
They're drive-in filler. That's all 60s shorts were for a million years. You know, all that Daffy Speedy crap and the later Woody Woodpeckers and Chili Willies. You know, these are just things that, you know, they need to run them in between movies and trailers, and that's all they were.
And it's so funny to me that Bakshi, just for being such a comic fan, and I know he worked with, you know, some big names in comics later on films, he just missed like the Silver Age boom that was kind of like when he entered at Terry Toons. Like, I was right before the Marvel Age of Comics began, and not to mention the indie comic boom as well. And this movie is all about comic books too. Like, so it seems like he just missed the window to be a comic artist.
Yeah, I don't know if he ever seriously considered a comic career, but you know, he's a very good cartoonist. I love all of Ralph's drawings, but yeah, he was always interested in the film aspect, so that's what he pursued, and that's what he knew.
So after leaving Paramount, in the late 60s, he opened Ralph Bakshi Productions in the Garment District of Manhattan in what he calls the worst neighborhood in the world. That's how he calls it. And they started off producing episodes of Rocket, Robin Hood, and Henry will love this, because I'm sure you know where I'm going, Henry.
Oh, yeah.
So he took over the Spider-Man's first TV series after the first animation studio went out of business. Mm-hmm. And from what I hear, during production, they were doing a lot of acid. And working on those cartoons.
Yeah, so those are some of the weirdest fucking cartoons there ever was. Like, they're the better ones. They don't tell good stories that just like rip off what Steve Ditko did. They're instead just like Spider-Man fights like a green goblin, not the Green Goblin, but like a giant pile of green gloop or whatever.
Right. Yeah, there's a, you know, each of these Bakshi productions are their own podcast. We're definitely not doing any of them justice. I mean, there was a whole thing where Ralph stole the production of one of these. I think it was Rocket Robin Hood from Canada, and they had a warrant out for his arrest. And at the border, he had the background painter, Dick Thomas, who had worked at Warner's forever. He said, "You take it in. I'm going to walk over the border."
Man.
Yeah, I think
I completely fucked that story up. Someone's gonna murder me because I did, but whatever. Leave it as is.
That I read that story, and I think it's a story that Bakshi is telling, so who knows how true it is, but he said to get across the border, he said, "Everyone's coming to Canada to get out of war. I'm coming into America." And they laughed at that and they let him in. So this was during Vietnam, of course.
That's funny.
Oh, he's full of shit with that. They had a warrant. He stole the production. He stole it.
He literally stole it. He does tell a lot of fun stories. And later in this podcast, you might ask yourself, should we believe them? Because a lot of conflicting stories with Cool World. But we must move on to what put Bakshi's name on the map. And that was Fritz the Cat. So Bakshi was sick of TV animation. He wanted to do something more experimental, more theatrical. His first pitch was what would be his second movie, which is Heavy Traffic. But his producer was like, "Nobody's going to buy this. You are a nobody in this world. You should adapt something." So he goes to Fritz the Cat, something he recently fell in love with. I believe he bought one of the trade paperbacks at a bookstore. He loved it. And again, this is another podcast we could do and probably will do, Fritz the Cat, because it's a big, big barrel of content we got to dig through. But it's a very important movie because Fritz the Cat is what basically bankrolls the rest of Bakshi's career up and through Cool World. Because it might seem to you and to me before doing this research, "Oh yeah, Fritz the Cat, what an odd little movie. What a blip on the radar of cinema." No. If Fritz the Cat was included in the top grossing movies of 1972, which it never is, because I think of its rating, it's just not included, it would be in the top 10.
Wow.
It would be in the top 10. It was made for under $1 million and it grossed $90 million worldwide. So it made back more than 10 times its production cost. And that is what made Bakshi, you know, able to make so many other movies after this.
Yes, it's definitely up there in the most important cartoons ever made. Yeah, even though it's a pretty bad movie. I do enjoy it. I mean, it's stupid, but, you know, the Crumb comics are kind of stupid too.
Yeah.
So I don't think he failed him as miserably as our Crumb says he did.
Yeah, it's funny how much Crumb hates it when it's like, it's kind of your thing.
It's hard to muster up much sympathy for him. Yes.
Yeah, I know it as like, it was so famous that it was something like my mom knew, like she was like, oh, the first X-rated cartoon, Fritz the Cat. We all know, like, if you live through that, they'll also like, my mom wasn't super into comics a bunch as a kid, but her brothers, like, they were the guys who bought all the, my uncle who lives in this area, like, he's the guy I learned about independent cartoons from in that era of comics from, like, he has tons of Arkham merch all around his home. I think his wife makes him keep it in one room.
Keep it in the crumb closet, please.
Yeah, that's a crumb closet.
Yeah, Arkham hates the movie. He killed the character off. I believe the rights to the movie were signed by his wife, who had power of attorney over him, so maybe that could be why he's mad about it. But yeah, that is Fritz the Cat, a huge movie, and it's so big that Bakshi can do whatever he wants for about 20 years. And I can just briefly name all the other movies he made. And again, this is just one podcast, and perhaps in the future we will revisit these. So 1972 is Heavy Traffic, 1975 is Coonskin, and then he gets into fantasy because those will be his most profitable movies after Fritz the Cat. So 77 is Wizards, 78 is Lord of the Rings. I was only made aware of Lord of the Rings because when that first movie came out in 2001, it was not available on DVD for a while, right? Like all movies. So yeah. Suncoast was like, fuck, put something on the screen that's Lord of the Rings. And so the movie was reprinted and I saw it everywhere. And it was always playing in Suncoast before Lord of the Rings actually came out on DVD.
Man.
Yeah, Bakshi was very adamant that Peter Jackson was inspired by him. You'll see a lot of press around that if you dig around online.
I'm sure
he was.
Yeah. If you listen to the commentary, I, as I recall back when I would spend a whole day listening to the extended edition commentaries for the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings, I think in the you'll occasionally hear him say, like, oh, that's kind of like from the Bakshi one, or we made this guy do this thing because I remember from the Bakshi one. Like, definitely Jackson was way more inspired by the Bakshi ones than the Rankin Bass ones. That's for darn sure. Yeah. Now it's funny to think back when I ever would give that much time to a Jackson thing. I watched all three Hobbits in theaters. Ooh. And like each film made me hate. I was like, was I wrong about the other three, or are they all? Is he just a bad movie director?
Yes.
That said it. So after Lord of the Rings in 78, we have American Pop in 81. We have Hey Good Looking in 82, and then back to fantasy with Fire and Ice in 83, and then Cool World is 92. So basically 9 years off for making movies for Ralph Bakshi.
Man, it's weird that Fire and Ice was. I watched Fire and Ice with a friend of mine because she was like, oh, you like Frazetta in these comics? You should have seen this movie. Like, he did a movie with Ralph Bakshi, and I it was pretty impressive. I'd never seen. I liked its sword and sorcery sex appeal stuff more than like heavy metal. Like, I think I don't know. I don't know how you feel, Thad, if you prefer comparing heavy metal, like, which I'm sure wouldn't exist if Fritz of the Cats wasn't a huge hit.
Right.
But, yeah.
A lot of these just roll together in my head. I mean, I haven't watched them since I was in college. I probably, except for his first three, I really can probably leave the rest of them without seeing them again in my lifetime. Well, especially American Pop, which is like, it's like 3 days long, it feels like.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess we can talk about some of the hallmarks of his animation, because unfortunately I think Ralph Bakshi is mostly known for the shortcuts he takes. And one of the biggest hallmarks of his style is rotoscoping, which is being heavily reliant on a live action reference for your animation. And that is evident throughout all of his work, even going back to Fritz the Cat, where a lot of the backgrounds are just photographs, heavily altered, but photographs of New York City. So he was always looking for shortcuts, and in some cases they really stick out as shortcuts, not an artistic choice.
Yeah, that is true, because he was always looking to try and bring his movies on time and on budget. I mean, that's one thing you have to give Ralph credit for. You know, he really wasn't looking to be rich from all this. I mean, he did end up being rich, but the whole era, this whole era brought up a couple of, you know, quote unquote auteurs in animation, Bakshi being one, Dick Williams being one, and Don Bluth being another. But Ralph's the, I don't like any of these guys personally. And, but I do, I respect Ralph more than the others because he was always interested in doing his own thing and actually doing it, you know, unlike another name on that list. But that being said, with all the shortcuts, the earlier movies, they really have some really great animation and choreography and layout in them. You know, you can sort of see some of these guys were in TV mode because sometimes it'll like revert. Oh, well, that kind of looks like a Pink Panther take right there. but on other times it's like, no, this is really good animation, you know, because he had, he made Fritz the Cat in both New York and LA. So there's a whole who's who of animation working on that, if you look at the credits. And there's a great article, I know nobody reads anymore, but Mike Barrier, the historian, in his old Funny World, he's got it up online. It's called The Filming of Fritz the Cat, and it's quite an amazing piece of literature considering he wrote that as the movie was being made. So I definitely look that up, anyone who's interested in Bakshi's early history. I mean, Heavy Traffic is probably my favorite of the Bakshi movies. I mean, it is the most autobiographical. I mean, because it's just who he is, a horny cartoonist who wants to screw black women. And, you know, that's who Ralph is to this day.
Yeah. And, I will say, in a lot of his movies, perhaps they're not as available or as talked about because they do delve into a lot of racial topics. They use a lot of racist imagery, not intending to be racist, but using it ironically, using it to comment on it.
In some cases, some cases less so, but we'll move on.
I mean, we don't have an irony ometer that you could run over.
But like, especially like Coonskin was, I mean, look at the name, of course. But
well, it's name. It's name, for Christ's sake.
I mean, you know, it was made at a different time, of course, but it was also like protested out of the movie theaters. It didn't make any money because everyone hated it. Nobody wanted to see it.
I have a write-up on my blog from an he was an old time, he goes back to the silent era, this animator Izzy Klein. I got access to a lot of his letters and paperwork, and he wrote a first-hand account of the premiere of Coonskin at MoMA, or was it MoMI, I forget, it was in New York, but when all that protesting happened. And Ralph put up a good show, but he was really shitting his pants. So,
I mean, like the phrase "it was a different time" is not really an excuse because, I mean, if you think about Song of the South, people go, "Oh, those people meant well." You know, it's just a charming movie. But then you look back and see, "Oh no, the NAACP was protesting it." And then you look back at Coonskin and say, "Like, oh, all of these groups are protesting it." So, people were they were not naive.
Well, Coonskin is a parody of Song of the South.
That too,
So, and it was directly calling out the racism of that film too. So, but doing a little, you know, every generation gets a little smarter and stupider. So, you got to take give and take, and that's not a very good movie either because there isn't a single likable character in that film. So. You know, that is an interesting failure, unlike Cool World.
Yeah. On the subject of rotoscoping, I've seen it come up every now and then in the animation discourse, and also we're for comic artists too. Like, is it like some people call it like tracing or treat it as like inartistic or lower quality? Like, I mean, you know, I don't think that's entirely fair. There are sometimes I've seen rotoscoping that does feel like tracing or less artistically driven than others. But I don't think in and of itself it is like a bad technique.
It still takes skill. It's like painting a still life or a landscape. It's just like, you could take a picture, but also painting it takes skill.
With Bakshi, it is bad. No, it's just he's saving money. He got hard from seeing how much the budget was getting slashed, and he wanted to make movies. So he just did it.
One thing I will say,
he'll lie and say otherwise, but that's it.
One thing I will say while doing research for this is, like, I'm not personally that interested in seeing a lot of Bakshi stuff, but it did make me wish that these kind of movies were still being made, these kind of animated movies that were taking risks, because I feel like, I don't know if it would have ever happened, but I feel like when Pixar got bought by Disney completely in 2006, that was the end of them as a truly independent creative studio that could have done different things. And now it's like, oh, Pixar, another movie about my feelings that makes me cry. What? Can't you do anything different? What?
And hey, I called that out about 15 years ago and everyone was wanting my head on a pike.
I'm sick of it.
Everybody's caught up to you now, Thad. I agree. Well, also, every Pixar, well, now I'm starting to notice every Pixar movie is about how, yeah, your job sucks, but just keep doing it. Yeah. Like, that also is the message.
Maybe Disney will buy you one day. Yeah. No, I mean, Pixar, I still appreciate their output, but, you know, there is a formula, and also learning about the original pitch from Cool World, I'm like, what if Pixar made a horror movie? That would be awesome. No one has made a CGI horror movie, and what is the last CGI movie or animated movie made for adults? Was it Beowulf?
I guess. So Zemeckis again, just like man, I can't, I mean, at least from a North American production, it's hard for me to think of another. Like, there's so, I mean, that's why, like, there's this bleeding over of, or trying to sell of, like, oh, you know, Spider-Verse is for everybody and it's actually got stuff that adults can appreciate, all these things, but, like, nobody can just make a grown-up film. I think in general, no corporation, few, want to spend $100 million or more, which is how it costs to make a theatrical feature animation. I don't think they want to spend that on a thing for adults. Like, that's just not what they're into.
Well, no, I think that was probably what Ralph's biggest failing was, is you couldn't get your shit together and make a film that was good, that could push forward this kind of movement where, you know, a Hollywood, an animated horror film would be viable and possible. I mean, I'm just looking at this list, and there isn't a single one where I love Heavy Traffic. I think it belongs up there with all the other 70s New York flavored movies, but there isn't a single one that's accessible to a general audience.
Oh yeah, no, they're. Yeah, I guess that is a big whiff on his part. When, and then sadly, most other guys, when they give the bat to so few people, and they and so rarely do they really hit a home run. Or even if they then hit a home run, then the next thing they do is, like, strike out every single time after that.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about Bakshi going back to TV animation, because this is what we've talked about the most in terms of his impact on that world, in that he was behind the very influential 1987 reboot of Mighty Mouse. And as I said earlier in this podcast, the staff of this project would go on to make the biggest 90s cartoons and play major artistic roles on things like Ren and Stimpy, Tiny Toons, and The Simpsons. So I'm not even going to name all of them, because it's everybody. So, like, Bruce Timm, Jim Reardon, John Chris Felucci, Tom Minton, Bob Jakes, Eddie Fitzgerald, Rich Moore, and more. And was Bob Camp?
Naylor was there day one too.
Naylor was
Smith. God, who else? There's Vicky Jensen.
Oh yeah,
talked about her. She started there. went on to direct Shrek.
The Shrek co-director.
Yes. And God, so many other people I can't name, but it's like, it's, somebody said in the commentaries, it's like you couldn't afford to get like a third of those people in the same room anymore. And you had them all working, you know, that's the thing. So with Bakshi, he was sort of trying to get out and trying to do live action after this. He was like, I don't think a lot of people know that he tried to get out of animation for a couple of years. And that's how he was trying to do it. What was the movie he was trying to pitch? It was called If I Catch Her, I'll Kill Her, or something like that. But that sort of led to him getting the Harlem Shuffle gig with the Rolling Stones. You know, he's yelling at them, "Hey Ringo, get over there!" You know, directing them. And John Chris Felucci had been, you know, trying to get stuff done with him as well, because, Birds of a Feather shit together. And what was he trying? Oh, a lot of people don't know. John was trying to get Ren and Stimpy made while on Bakshi's payroll. So technically Ralph kind of owns a piece of that, but I think Ralph has stated on record, probably because of me, that he said John can just have them. But I think that was sort of retroactive. He probably, if he wanted to, he probably could. But yeah, then they did that Harlem Shuffle video that had a John, Lynn, Bob, Jim, Vicky worked on that. She painted the backgrounds. Pat Ventura worked on that as well. And then, you know, that got Ralph back. That got Ralph Bakshi interested in animation again. And they were trying to see what they could sell. They actually had an adult animated feature in development with Columbia TriStar. It was called Bobby's World. You'll probably see it. Bobby's Girl.
Okay.
Bobby's Girl is the name of the movie. Not that TV show. Bobby's Girl was the name of the feature, and it was supposed to be one of those, you know, nostalgic 50s sex comedies with lots of, you know, not too well-aged imagery. But that would have been fascinating to see in 1986. But, you know, that Columbia lost interest and money ran out after the script and screenplay was written. There's a lot of developmental art. There's a lot of development art online by Lynn and a few of the others if you look for it. Then that led to them trying to get stuff going for TV. They one of the things Ralph had planned, I know some of the stories are told differently, but Ralph had always planned to pitch a Mighty Mouse reprisal to CBS because, you know, he started at Terry Toons and, you know, CBS loved the idea, and they sold it in April of 1987, and they had to get 13 half hours on the air for September. So
wow.
That's how that worked.
Yeah.
And basically nobody did anything but work on the show for about 2 or 3 months, working 60-hour weeks. And, you know, John would check out and consume alcohol. No one would find him. But no, that, you know, what the irony was, John's contract at the time was, I can't miss any deadlines or I'm fired. You know?
Oh, well, that's pretty ironic.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Knowing
that's the only reason that show got made was because Ralph Bakshi was in charge.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, just looking at it, he finishes shit. You're right. He can actually at least release a thing and put it out. Yeah.
And despite how like a body character he is and kind of like aggressive, this guy, Ralph Bakshi, you would see caricatures of him in these artists' later work. Like Ralph the Guard from Animaniacs is Ralph Bakshi.
Yes.
I'm sure the loutish oafs on Ren and Stimpy are based on Ralph Bakshi.
Mm-hmm.
For the rancid Ren and Stimpy reboot on Spike TV, Ralph Bakshi is the star of Fire Dogs 2, and because the cartoon was not finished for its original airing, there are wraparounds where Ralph Bakshi is playing like a black and white sitcom character.
Yes, he's doing the Honeymooners. Yep. What, yep. That was Ralph's idea, because he was a master at cheap solutions. Like, well, just do this real quick, you know.
Build some sets.
You know, that's I guess that is the same kind of spirit of Cool World there as well. That just a cheap solution to a deadline issue.
So we could talk about the rest of Ralph's TV work before we get to Cool World. So he was the director and creator of the Nickelodeon Christmas in Tattertown special, and that was going to be the first quote unquote Nicktoon. I don't know why it didn't happen, but speculation is because of the Mighty Mouse, the cocaine. This is so complicated to get into, but on an episode of Mighty Mouse, there was a joke in which Mighty Mouse crushes a dried flower in his hand and sniffs it, and it goes into his nose like cocaine. And yes, they were making a cocaine joke. Ren and Stimpy made a lot of, you know, off the wall jokes that went over kids' heads, but on a rerun of that, somebody saw it and got mad. It wasn't even on the first airing, it was on a much later rerun. So people were speculating because of the controversy of that joke that got the show canceled, probably. The Tattertown. Yeah, the Tattertown series didn't happen because of the controversy.
That's actually Tattertown was after Mighty Mouse.
Right.
And after that controversy. So that was, you know, maybe because Tattertown sucks, they didn't want to do it. I mean, who knows?
There's a lot of Cool World in Tattertown as well. Like, yeah, I think definitely some ideas. To think that, like, wasn't the rumor that Tattertown, like, the deal was for the, you know, the full 52 kind of syndicatable package deal? Like, they, to that Bakshi would have been working on that for like 4 years or something if they'd actually ordered that.
When you name something Tattertown, you're implying a world of characters that will expand, not just one special.
when I recall watching it when it was new, because Nickelodeon promoted it so much, like, wow, a big, and I was, you know, I still love Christmas specials, and I watched it, and like, it was another of those that just like made me sad or just flat. Like, I did not like it as a child. That was probably the first, no, I watched Mighty Mouse before it, so no, that was the first Bakshi thing I saw. Yeah,
and I think our friend Poparina has a video on that on their Knickknacks series.
Yeah, check that out. It's very informative.
So before we get to Cool World, I can go over a few of the things Bakshi did for TV right before Cool World. So he adapted Seuss's The Butcher Battle Book, and he created an unsold pilot called Houndtown, which you can watch on YouTube in just awful, terrible quality. it's unwatchable on YouTube, but there's proof it exists.
As a kid, I remember liking that Butter Battle thing, but maybe it's just that I like that original book. But I thought that was okay.
It was one of the few things Ted Geisel was pleased with, even though he was fired off of it.
What? Jesus. Wow. Man, we're touching upon 20 podcastable subjects here.
But yes.
Well, that's the other thing we didn't get into about Ralph, is that anyone who's worked for him was probably fired by him at some point. So very few can claim that they weren't.
No,
and if they do, they're probably lying.